Hi. I hope, hello everybody. I hope you can all hear me. My name's Mervyn Singer. I'm delighted to be speaking to you, and I've got Danielle De Backer, our president of the society, who will be the moderator. So I'll talk for about 20 minutes, covering the definitions, but talking about some of the nuances, and then please do ask questions, and I'll try my best to answer them. So hopefully many of you will have seen the paper that came out a few days ago, and there are the few companion papers which give the data that underpin the new definitions and the new clinical criteria. Clearly, the old versions needed updating. We had sepsis 1 from 1991, sepsis 2 from 2000, and there are lots of issues and problems. Clearly, sepsis included the need for two of the four SIRS criteria, and many studies show that these are reasonably sensitive but poorly specific. This paper from the Australian group showed that one in eight patients with infection and organ failure admitted to Australian ICUs did not have the SIRS criteria, and they still, many of them died. This paper, recent paper from America, showed that half of the patients admitted to hospital had two or more of the SIRS criteria at least once during their ward stay, and they argued that it wasn't a practical method to screen for sepsis. Because no definitions have been applied, so severe sepsis meant organ dysfunction, but in the old definitions, nobody said what they meant by organ dysfunction, so it can be defined in different ways. There were some American studies, this is I'm showing here, a sort of meta-analysis, so to speak, but they found that depending on how you defined organ dysfunction, you could have very different numbers of cases, ranging from 900,000 to 3 million, and that's looking at the same database, or the total mortality varied from 250,000 to nearly 400,000. So again, depending on how you defined sepsis, you can get very different numbers for incidence and for mortality. So it's important we all speak the same language and everyone knows what everyone else is talking about. So septic shock is also variably defined, and when we looked at the literature, we did a systematic review. There are many, many, many ways of defining a patient as having septic shock, different levels of blood pressure, maybe they require the need to know how much fluid they've had, different levels of lactate and/or vase deficit, use of vasopressors, SOFA scores, lots of different ways, and as a result, there's a huge variation in mortality, a greater than fourfold variation in mortality. So for example, the Australians recently reported a 22% mortality, and we've got data, recent data from Germany, from the Netherlands, where they're reporting 60% mortality. Does that mean the Australians are three times better? I think the answer is no, because they define shock in a very, very, very different way. So it was about time for a change, a review of where we are. So with funding support from the European Society and the Society of Critical Care Medicine, a task force was put together. So myself and Cliff Deutschman were co-chairing it. We put together a group from different continents, different backgrounds. They had different interests in sepsis. They all had expertise. Some were more interested in the basic science and the mechanism, others were epidemiologists, others were clinical trialists. And so we had this nice blend of people who would give strong opinions, and they offered different perspectives about sepsis. It's been really useful to have what we did was a soft launch. So we've been talking about this for the last year and getting very good feedback. informal peer review, and obviously once we'd written the papers, it went to our parent societies, but also to over 30 societies around the world, national, international, infectious disease, microbiology, thoracic, acute medicine, emergency medicine, critical care, and so forth. And these were both in developed countries and low and middle income countries. And obviously, as part of the JAMA review process, we also got more peer review. So it helped us try and dispel disinformation, but at the same time, if things were not clear, it helped us try as best as we could to express them better. And we felt very strongly we needed to look at data. So rather than just some old farts sitting around the table making decisions, we thought our decisions should be informed by data. And now we have the availability of big data. We thought, okay, that will underpin the recommendations we make. And so we had access to large databases of electronic health records. They're all United States ones because they have the data, they collect all of the data on patients in hospital, not just in the ICU. So our base database was the 12 hospitals in the University of Pittsburgh system. So there are large university hospitals and community hospitals. We also had other databases, the Kaiser Permanente system, which had 20 hospitals, the Veterans Association Administration hospitals, 130, and we went to Germany, and they kindly gave us their database collection, nearly 40,000 patients, and we also had access to 50,000 patients from an out-of-hospital emergency medicine database and 14 hospitals. So in total, there were about 8 million patients we could look at, and we looked at patients who had cultures taken and at least two courses of antibiotic. So these were the patients we thought would have presumed infection. Only a minority, only 6%, had a bacteremia, but many were treated suspicion of having infection. So we looked at those. And as you see here in the Pittsburgh database, 11% of the total hospital population, the majority were from the emergency department or the ward, but the vast majority were non-ICU, and 11% of the total hospital population had an antibiotic given, cultures taken. An important point I'd like to make here is that only 4% of these patients actually died. So it's not that infection kills everybody, and these are patients who are in hospital either because they developed infection as the reason for admission, or they developed a nosocomial infection when they were in hospital for another reason, after an operation, for example. So only a small number of the patients, 1 in 25, died of infection or presumed infection. And we don't know how many of these were, for example, terminal care patients, where they had malignant cancer, not treatable, they got an infection that wasn't treated, or it wasn't aggressively treated in terms of intensive care. So we don't know that number, but only a minority of the total pool of patients developed organ failure, went on to die. And I think that's an important perspective to bear in mind. A minority of patients with infection go on to get septic. Obviously, more will develop organ dysfunction and may survive. Only a small proportion die. And so we looked at these healthcare records. We picked out the patients who had had cultures and antibiotics, but we excluded prophylactic antibiotics, intraoperative antibiotics, and we looked when infection was first suspected. And clearly, there needs to be, you know, when you suspect infection, you need to look at a window before you take cultures and after. And Chris Seymour, who did the hard work on this, looked at a 72-hour window, and he also looked at a 6-hour window, 3 hours before, 3 hours after, and in fact the data are very equivalent. So we looked at different windows before and after the cultures were taken and antibiotics begun. So we all agreed, the task force all agreed, it wasn't difficult to agree on the fact that we thought SIRS, the concept, was outdated. It's more than just infection and inflammation, and the host response is key. So you get this dysregulated host response. So rather than an appropriate response to an infection, the body reacts to it, deals with it, the patient gets better. In this situation, it becomes dysregulated, they get organ dysfunction, they may go on to die. So we wanted to differentiate straightforward sepsis from straightforward infection from those patients who develop organ dysfunction, the infection that goes bad. And that's what we wanted sepsis to now represent. Patients with infection who develop organ dysfunction and may go on to die. So what used to be called severe sepsis becomes now redundant. This is the new sepsis. And we wanted septic shock to reflect a sicker subset of the septic patient population. So in the old criteria, you had this continuum of infection, sepsis, severe sepsis, septic shock, and now we've simplified it. You have infection, when it goes bad, you get organ dysfunction, you have sepsis, and septic shock is now a subset of this septic population. So we've tried to simplify the language, the nomenclature. So the new definition, which I'm sure you've probably seen, sepsis is life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. The key distinctions, we wanted organ dysfunction in there to differentiate it from a straightforward infection. So as I mentioned before, the old severe sepsis now becomes sepsis. And dysregulated host response to differentiate it from an appropriate normal response to infection that doesn't lead to organ dysfunction, organ failure. So now we have a definition, but how do we measure, how do we characterize organ dysfunction at the bedside? And so we had lots of discussion and we decided to use the SOFA score, or more particularly a change in SOFA score of two or more related to that episode of infection. I'll explain why we wanted a change. So this is just to remind you about the SOFA score. It uses six criteria and you score increasing points for severity. So we only wanted a change, quite a small change of two or more. And Chris Seymour in his analysis found that just having two or more SOFA points gave you a 10% risk of dying. So in other words, even though it's a mild change in SOFA score, there's a big consequence in terms of risk of dying, 1 in 10. We'll talk about the change in SOFA in the next slide. So this just emphasizes this point, a 10% risk of dying if you have infection and two or more SOFA points. So why did we need a change rather than just the baseline? Well, clearly many patients have comorbidities. They may have existing chronic renal failure. They'll have SOFA points at baseline. They may have come into hospital with a stroke or a head injury. They'll get Glasgow coma points, Glasgow coma scale points for their head injury. So we wanted to therefore look at a change from baseline. So many of these patients, either new admissions or people with existing comorbidities, they'll be known about. We'll know what their creatinine was if they have chronic kidney disease. So we'll already know that. So we're not saying you need to do the SOFA twice. We're looking for a change related to the pre-infection baseline. And if they were previously healthy, you could assume zero SOFA score points. So previously healthy, you measure the SOFA score, you can see the change. If they had comorbidities, chronic or relatively new, again, that would likely be known in the majority of patients. moving to septic shock, we wanted this to reflect a more severe population, and from a pathophysiological point of view, it's not just a low blood pressure, it's not just the circulation. You've got a combination of circulatory, cellular, metabolic abnormalities, and if you put those together, the risk of dying is much higher. So again, how do we operationalize this? How do we give the bedside clinician the means of describing septic shock? Which clinical criteria should we use? So for this, we went, and Manu Shankarhari did the hard work here, we went to the Surviving Sepsis Campaign database, 28,000 patients, and we validated it against the Kaiser and the Pennsylvania Hospital database I talked about earlier. We agreed that we wanted to look at a combination of circulatory dysfunction, hypotension after adequate fluid resuscitation. We couldn't define adequate. There's no literature to say what adequate means. Different people believe it means different things. Some people measure cardiac output, some do Starling curves, some don't. So at the end of the day, we said, in your practice, do what you think is adequate. If they're still hypotensive, despite adequate fluid, and you need to get the blood pressure 65 or above with vasopressors, that counts as circulatory dysfunction, and we're using lactate as a marker of metabolic cell stress. And we looked at acute hospital mortality as our outcome. So when we looked at that, this combination of a low blood pressure, needing vasopressors, and a lactate of above 2 gave these patients a mortality of about 42-43%, which was much higher than hypotension needing vasopressors alone with a normal lactate, or having a high lactate alone but no hypotension, which was 25-30%. If you had neither hypotension needing vasopressors nor a high lactate, your mortality was about 18%. So this group here, needing a high lactate and vasopressors, both criteria, gave you a much higher mortality. So that's how we came up with the clinical criteria. A lactate above 2, vasopressors needed to keep the blood pressure at 65 despite adequate fluid. Why 2? Why not 3? Why not 4? Well, the negative predictive value was similar whether you use 2 or 3 or 4, but the sensitivity was far better. So you picked up most of the patients who would die by using 2. So you would halve the patients you detected if you used a lactate of 4. So many patients, despite not having a very high lactate, will do badly. So a lactate of 2 was the best in terms of sensitivity and specificity. The final thing I'll just mention before we just come up with some of the frequently asked questions is, okay, so we have SOFA, we have septic shock. Can we come up with a quick bedside prompt, a sniffer, to rapidly identify at the bedside those patients at risk of having sepsis, in other words, organ dysfunction? So we developed, and Chris Seymour did the hard work, this quick SOFA concept. He looked at 21 variables that have been highlighted in sepsis 2. Temperature, lactate, blood pressure, heart rate, urine output, things that are routinely measured in patients. And he did lots of statistics to find which were the best at coming up with predicting in hospital mortality. And he found respiratory rate, 22 or above, altered mentation and a systolic blood pressure less than 100 were very good predictors. If you had none of these at the time infection was predicted, the mortality was about 1%, less than 1%. If you had one of these three criteria, the mortality was about 3%. If you had two of the criteria, 8%. If you had three or more, it was over 20%. So there's good predictive validity for identifying those infected patients or suspected infected patients who are at high risk of doing badly. And when he compared it with SIRS and the SOFA thing, inside the ICU, it wasn't as robust as SOFA. It was as good as SIRS, but clearly in the ICU, we ventilate the patient, we sedate them, we give them pressors, and so these factors I talked about earlier are altered by what we do in intensive care. However, on the ward outside the ICU, in the emergency department and the ward, it was as good as the SOFA score. Superior to SIRS, but as good as SOFA. So it's not so good in the ICU where we interfere medically, but as good as SOFA in predicting patients who would do badly. And when Chris looked at it in different data sets, Kaiser, veterans, the German, the emergency medicine thing, again, the area under the curve was pretty good, between 0.7 and 0.8. Why didn't we use lactate in this model? Well, basically, when he did his statistics, his regression analysis, lactate didn't add anything to having two or more SOFA points. So the lactate in itself offered nothing. And here, looking at different risks of in-hospital mortality. So people at the low end are young, fit, and healthy. People at the high end are old and lots of disabilities. But adding in lactate to two Q for criteria, two Q SOFA criteria, didn't add anything to the prognostic validity. So just to re-emphasize this, and then the last few minutes talking about sort of limitations and concerns, sepsis, you need to do SOFA scoring, a new infection, and a change of two or more SOFA points. Outside the ICU, you see a patient, in 1-2 minutes, you can work out whether these patients are at high risk of having sepsis. Clearly, you would need to then, if you're clinically worried, regardless of whether they hit 2Q SOFA points or not, you would then think about doing the blood test to say, have they got renal failure, coagulation problems, etc., which would allow you to measure SOFA. But the SOFA scoring should come as a byproduct of the clinical tests you would be doing anyway in a sick patient, blood gases, renal function, etc. So in the document, in the paper, we were allowed by the JAMA editor, Howard Bauchner, very kindly to exceed our word count and put in this section on controversies and limitations, because we recognize this cannot be perfect. You know, sepsis is a syndrome. We don't have an easy blood test. So in the lack of that easy diagnosis of a syndrome, we have to come up with the best we could, understanding the underlying pathobiology, but at the same time trying to make it easy for somebody at the bedside working clinically to understand what's going on. So is there still a place for SIRS, for lactate? Well, clearly, you know, when you're making your initial diagnosis of infection, it's useful to look at the patient, temperature, their white count, etc. So SIRS does help you in forming a diagnosis of perhaps they may have an infection, and clearly you do cultures to formally diagnose it. The same with lactate. You know, I like lactate as a management tool. We're not saying don't use lactate. Please, if you like lactate, to see if your patient is getting better when you give fluid or whatever, carry on using it. But in terms of just purely the diagnosis of sepsis, it didn't add anything to the Q SOFA. It's not in the SOFA score, so we thought for that purpose it's not necessary. However, as I mentioned earlier, it is necessary for septic shock, because it's the best readily available marker we have for cellular metabolic stress. Again, it's not perfect. Lactate goes up for other reasons. But in terms of having something that most people can measure, lactate is a good surrogate for this stressed cell. Some people have said, well, oh, these new criteria will mean you'll delay treating the patient. Absolutely not. You look at the patient in front of you. If you're worried that they have a bad infection that needs antibiotics, antibiotics, you'll treat them. If they have oliguria or they're hypoxemic, again, you'll treat them. So you don't have to wait until they hit magical diagnostic criteria before you treat the patient in front of you. So absolutely, please don't wait until they're ill before you start treating them. But this is in terms of just giving the same language, standardizing, you know, this is when infection becomes sepsis. As I mentioned before, sepsis is a syndrome, a label. So it's like infection. You often presume they've got an infection, but until you see how it evolves, it may often retrospectively turn out not to be infection. There was a lovely trial or study from Holland, Tom van der Poel's group, where they showed that half of all the patients admitted to intensive care with presumed infection, a quarter definitely had it, a quarter probably had it, a quarter possibly had it, and a quarter didn't have it. So sepsis is a label, and you often make that diagnosis retrospectively because you don't know if they've got infection often until retrospectively it's made. However, knowing that they've hit two or more Q-SOFA criteria or their delta SOFA, their rise of SOFA of two or more, or septic shock, if they fulfill those criteria, it does identify that patient in front of you of being at much greater risk of doing badly. So if you're already not thinking, do they need intensive care, do they need more investigations, interventions, it's a way of prompting you to remind you that these patients are at much higher risk. So what do the new definitions criteria bring? Well, we hope that they're more objective. We've told people what we mean by organ dysfunction. We've told people what we mean by septic shock. So we can be more objective in our reporting, more reproducible. We can make better comparisons between hospitals, between countries, between the same hospital over time. And because we've picked criteria that are readily recorded in many hospitals, it's generalizable. So we're not asking for a very expensive biomarker, but we're offering something that's available to most places and generalizable. So it will clearly help research, coding, epidemiology, but we also hope it will help the bedside practice. The Q-SOFA is an early warning prompt to make you worried about the patient if you're already not. Sorry, you may already be worried, but this is a way of saying worry more if you haven't noticed that. And the SOFA, as I mentioned before, is using blood tests and clinical measures that are performed routinely in any sick patient. In our ICU, the computer measures it automatically, so I think many ICU computerized systems will measure it daily automatically. Last few slides, what about children? Well, we think the definitions of sepsis still hold true, but we lack the expertise to look at children at different ages, from babies through to adolescents. So there are pediatric initiatives underway to try and come up with clinical criteria for children, so we just stuck with adults for simplicity, accepting that obviously you do get physiological changes between young adults and old adults, but by and large, it's much less than between neonates and teenagers. The developing world, we had lots of discussion in our peer review. We went to societies from developing world countries, and we recognize that in some hospitals, they may not have the ability to measure lactate or do the blood test to look at organ dysfunction. Potentially, we could use Q-SOFA as a surrogate. Because it's a retrospective diagnosis on a database, we need to do prospective studies to make sure Q-SOFA is robust. The studies were mainly done in American hospitals. It needs to be done in non-US hospitals, developed world, developing world, to make sure it is a robust marker. Likewise, if you can't measure lactate, use another surrogate of poor perfusion. You know, there are studies, for example, showing capillary refill is a marker of poor prognosis. So again, that's one example. So we recognize that the whole world might not be able to measure lactate and so forth, but at least we're offering alternatives. With point-of-care testing, it's becoming increasingly available and cheap. Hopefully, it may expand the availability to poorer countries. What next? Again, we want the prospective validations of QSOFA in different healthcare settings, and we think SOFA, again, it's not without its problems. There are therapeutic interventions, etc., but it's been around for a long time. There's lots of predictive validity associated with SOFA. The more SOFA points, the more likely the patient is to die. So we thought, because there's a lot of new things, we stick with SOFA for the time being, but hopefully when it comes to sepsis 4, then there may be a better alternative. So finally, you know, we hope we've offered a more scientific approach. We've used data, we've come up with objective criteria that hopefully will be useful at the bedside. We need to prospectively validate them, so please do so in your hospitals, your countries. And it's not the final word. You know, this is part of an ongoing process. As our knowledge improves, our diagnostics improve, there will be new criteria that will come forward, maybe new definitions. So sepsis 4, when it happens, will be an improvement, we hope, on sepsis 3. We hope this is an improvement on sepsis 2, which was 13 years ago. On that, I thank you very much for listening, and I'll hand you back to Daniel to moderate.
Thank you very, very much, Mervyn. This is indeed a very clear presentation, and many of the comments we already received were pointing out of this. Before I ask you the question of the audience, there are still many people on the line, so do not hesitate to raise your questions. I will try to look at your questions while Mervyn is answering these. One of the first question was really what will these definitions change on the, let's say, management of our patients regarding resuscitation, because maybe early goal-directed therapy, if you still use it, because diagnosis and recognition of sepsis is really a key issue. So do you think that recognition will be, with this kind of QSOFA and others, better obtained, or what is your feeling about this, Mervyn?
Yeah. No, thank you, Daniel. My personal feeling, again, you... Obviously, we're making recommendations. One of the things we were very clear not to do was talk about management. You know, there's new surviving sepsis campaign guidelines coming out maybe by the end of this year. So we were very careful not to intrude on their territory. So we didn't talk about management. Clearly, you know, we're showing that, you know, the criteria we're offering give prognostic validity. So therefore, you know, again, we're not saying wait until the patients get sick and then start treating them, but clearly if you identify them at higher risk, you need to be much more active. It's a label. In the UK, there's a national early warning score system called NEWS, which has 7 criteria, and interestingly, the 3 QSOFA criteria are within the 7 national criteria in the UK. In the UK, and basically if a score of 4 or 5 in this new system, that's when a doctor gets called, and that actually equates to having 2 QSOFA criteria. So there's very nice homology between what's done in the UK, but many hospitals don't use early warning scores on the ward or in the emergency department, so, you know, use an early warning score would be my recommendation. QSOFA may be a brilliant score, as I've stressed before, it does need prospective validation, but we're saying, you know, some people with infection may not need to treat. You know, you may need to just observe them. you know, if they've got a cannula in, you take out the cannula. But it doesn't mean, certainly my practice, every patient with infection, it doesn't mean you have to immediately rush in an antibiotic. The very sick ones, obviously, I think you need to be more urgent in when you start an antibiotic. So clinical management is a judgment call. We're not saying the definitions should change management, but it just alerts you that the patient in front of you is a much sicker patient than perhaps somebody with straightforward infection.
Regarding the combination, of course, of your diagnosis of the there is some echo there. So the diagnosis of echo oh my gosh. So the diagnosis of the infection on one hand, and cues of abnormalities and others. What is exactly this time delay? Do we have a definite window we need to look at, or we can have several days?
Yeah. Well, I think, in fact, actually, that point just come up, and we're just discussing that amongst the task force, because what Chris Seymour did was he showed that, you know, you could do it within a window around the time you see the patient. So my advice would be you can score the patient in front of you as you see them, and clearly you can monitor the patient because they're easy bedside tests. You don't need to do blood tests. So if the patient evolves from naught at the time you see them to one to two, then clearly you need to worry more than the patient who is naught. So it helps the nurses, perhaps they increase the intensity of monitoring. So if the patient has gone from 0 to 1, that may worry you because of other reasons to call critical care, but it may be that they can be managed off the ward, but if they go from 1 to 0, that's a good sign. If they go from 1 to 2, warning, you know, think about escalating care, maybe referral to critical care, if it's not already happened. So you can use it as a trend follower, and I think that might be like an early warning score, the utility.
And Mervyn, there were many questions about the way infection is diagnosed. Do we agree that we can say that indeed it is mostly whatever the way you diagnose infection, once it is diagnosed, having the changes in the SOFA score in the ICU or the two or three QSOFA points helps you to indeed identify that this patient is septic, once again, whatever the way you diagnose the infection. Okay, it seems that we have lost Mervyn at this stage. At least myself, I do not hear him. So I think that we have an issue with Mervyn Singer, so I will answer some of the question while waiting that Mervyn is coming back. There were some question about the use of the way you diagnose the infection. And so basically what was discussed in the task force is that the way you diagnose infection is the way you do usually. So you have a perforated bowel, this is an infection, you don't need to have a positive blood culture or whatever to diagnose it. If you have some other way to diagnose it, it's okay, of course. And so this is the way we diagnose infection. And then, of course, when you have the signs of the QSOFA and other measurements like the changes in SOFA, then indeed you get the diagnosis. Yes, Mervyn, you are back.
Hi, Daniel. I can't. Hi, Estelle. Could you mute me while Daniel talks?
So, Mervyn, do you hear me now?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so I will ask you a few new questions.
Please.
So, what about some subgroups like postoperative patients, like burns, pregnancy, and so on?
Burns, pregnancy, and so on.
Yeah. Again, you know, we didn't look in our analyses at specific subgroups. Clearly, there will be postoperative patients, there will be burns, there will be whatever. Clearly, you know, when they come in with their pregnancy, they may have a low blood pressure and their respiratory rate may be a bit high because they're pregnant. You know, that's normal physiology. And so you're looking for the change, and that's why we're emphasizing change. Again, the prospective validation in postoperative patients, burn patients, will be needed just to check how robust QSOFA is in these populations. Hello?
Yes,
sir. Oh. Yeah, sorry, I've gone silent yes, at your end.
No, at the end it was a little bit silent indeed. So about again the QSOFA, there was a question about the potential risk of overuse of antibiotics. Can you mention a little bit more about the specificity and not only sensibility of this criteria?
Well, again, it's not. We're not at the moment. Again, it's the clinical management. Obviously, is for others to decide. So we're just providing definitions and clinical criteria. They're not just because they fulfill a label doesn't mean, oh, now they're septic, we start treating them, but before they were septic, we won't treat them. We're absolutely not saying that. If you're worried about an infection that needs an antibiotic, give them an antibiotic. If you're not worried about the infection, that they need an antibiotic, that they'll recover, don't give an antibiotic, but monitor the patient, and if they get worse, then start. So clearly, that's a clinical judgment call. So we're not providing cutoffs to start or not start an antibiotic. We're just saying these are the ways of characterizing sepsis, and clearly, we're identifying people at high risk of doing badly. So it may be that if you are at high risk of doing badly, you should get your antibiotics, but if you're not, then you don't need to. So if you look at the QSOFA paper, only about 22% of all of the patients with infection had two or more QSOFA points. So therefore, hopefully, I'm a big believer in antibiotic stewardship. So that means hopefully not every patient will automatically get an antibiotic. We can offer some degree of better scrutiny.
Yes, but if you diagnose infection, because this is a basis, I mean, you have to begin with infection, and then when you discover the QSOFA, this will be indeed identifying the patient who are the more severe. But on the other hand, and when you discover a QSOFA, which is about two or three, but if you know proven infection, what do you do in these conditions?
If you're clinically worried, You know these patients are at higher risk. If you're clinically worried, just like you would normally, you would start treating them. So you would take your cultures, you would start empiric antibiotics, you would do your imaging to look for an abscess or a perforation. So the formal diagnosis is a label. It shouldn't change your clinical management. You treat the oliguria, the hypoxemia, you treat all of these things as you would. We're just saying, you know, just because they have a label doesn't mean the patient should be treated differently.
Okay, I think this is very important in the answer several questions about the use of a procalcitonin and other things to diagnose infection, and I think it's exactly in the same line. I would like to jump to another point, which was the definition of septic shock. And several questions pointed out, you use mostly the systolic pressure. Any reason not to use the mean arterial pressure or even perhaps diastolic pressure in these patients?
The pragmatic reason is on the ward, so for QSOFA, and in fact also in SOFA, but QSOFA, you're looking at systolic pressure. The reason is on the ward, it's more reliable with the sphygmomanometer to measure systolic than mean, because often the diastolic is hard to measure. And so there's much more inter operator variability. So systolic blood pressure is more reliable in a ward setting with a sphygmomanometer. In the ICU, mean arterial pressure is more readily measured, and that probably is more reliable with an arterial transduce trace because, you know, of underdamping and overdamping, so the mean pressure is a more reliable measure. And again, using the database, we use the Surviving Sepsis Campaign database of nearly 30,000 patients. They use mean, so we thought, well, we'd use mean for that, and there were good reasons. So by and large, a septic shock patient, if they're not already in the ICU, if you're actively treating them, they should be going to the ICU, and many of these patients will be invasively monitored. So that's why we picked mean blood pressure for septic shock.
Okay, and a question was arose about the patient who were previously hypertensive. Do you still use the cutoff at 100, or you may use a higher cutoff?
I'm muted. Again, we just went for a pragmatic decision. We thought, well, again, in the old definition, it was a drop of 40 from baseline. In many occasions, you don't know where baseline was. So it was a pragmatic decision. You know, again, there was no right answer. In the end, we had a majority view to try and keep it simple to say, okay, it's just whether they have high blood pressure normally or not. Again, that's where we need the prospective data, but often in many patients, we don't know what their normal blood pressure is. Again, you know, from a treatment point of view, if you're worried about the patient, you would treat them. If that blood pressure, even if their mean is 70 and they're not passing urine because they're chronically hypertensive, you would treat them. Just because they do or don't fulfill the label is not relevant to the clinical management. The label is more useful for the coding and the epidemiology, et cetera.
Okay. Some people are asking, they are doing trials with the old definitions. Should they make an amendment and change during their trial their definition to the new one, or should they keep on the old one during their ongoing trial?
Well, again, I've been asked this question before. I think it's an important question. I think the advice I would give is, obviously, if your entry criteria were predicated on the old criteria, you have to stick with the old criteria. I think it's useful, even retrospectively, to look at the new criteria and just report that, well, yes, we started with the old criteria, but these are the results retrospectively for the new criteria. And as I said, what we're offering should be routinely recorded in the clinical record forms for these trial patients. So if entry criteria is determined by SIRS or whatever, stick with that, but then try and show with the new criteria how they relate, because there will be this sort of overlap period, you know, while the old goes out and the new goes in.
Okay. Again, some question about the diagnosis of septic shock. You mentioned the fact that the patient with septic shock were characterized by use of vasopressors and an increased lactate level. Do these need to be exactly, let's say, at the same time, or were there covered over some time, and that you may perhaps sometimes have a time delay? Let's say this morning I had a lactate of 4 in one patient. At that time he was not under vasopressors. I give some volume, but nevertheless blood pressure decreases. Now he's under vasopressors, but lactate is 1.9. Can I qualify this patient on septic shock, or is it not a septic shock at this stage, according to the new definitions?
Well, my thing, again, as I mentioned earlier, we're actually, this point just come up recently, and I want to make sure we get consistency from all the task force. My personal view is probably it needs to be done fairly concurrently, because, you know, we're saying you need both, and the Surviving Sepsis Campaign database was using both concurrently. rather than one and then one happening later, you know, because you may have a high lactate that can come down. But we'll give clarity on that point later on. But my personal view is probably it needs to be done at the same time for consistency.
Okay. Because for the QSFI, it was a 6 hours delay or window that we can look at. Agreed?
You're looking immediately at the bedside. You can do that there and then. So I would argue, I made the point earlier, that you can do the QSOFA every hour, every 10 minutes if you wish, mm-hmm. and look at the change. So the QSOFA you can probably do there and then, and the septic shock probably the same. But we'll give clarity on that soon.
There are some discussion on, do you think that these definitions can help also to identify the resolution of sepsis, meaning that when you do not have any more these criteria, you can say that sepsis is over at that time?
Well, again, a very good question. We, in fact, we're just finishing a study in the UK on looking at levosimendan in septic shock, and we're using the SOFA score and looking at the change in SOFA score. So you could make the argument that the SOFA score might be useful. Obviously, the problem there is the patient may be left with chronic renal failure for a month or two, and so they'll carry on scoring SOFA points, but they may be able to leave the ICU. So again, my answer would be maybe, but it needs work specifically looking prospectively at that question.
Okay. Another question on septic shock. You mentioned, of course, the use of lactate. What about some other markers let's say, cellular crisis, if you have it available at the bedside, meaning if you have a metabolic acidosis, if you measure a strong iron difference, you have an increased strong iron difference, or some other factors like this, could these be used as a surrogate of lactate, or you need to be really rigid on lactate for this?
Yeah, what we did there was, again, we had lots of discussion about that, and we thought, again, to try and keep it easy and standardize it. So essentially, if you can look at strong iron difference, you can probably measure lactate. So rather than complicate issues, we really wanted simplicity. So we thought, let's stick with lactate, because there are many other reasons why the base deficit or the strong iron gap may change, you know, give too much saline, you can cause that effect. So that's why, for better for worse, you know, lactate is probably the best single marker of what we currently have as a marker of metabolic stress. You know, the other things are also confounded, you know, by treatment interventions.
Okay, and regarding some other signs of a tissue hypoperfusion, like it was a question about capillary refill time, do this enter into the definition, or is just an add-on when you have the definition that indeed this is a patient with some impaired tissue perfusion?
Again, as we wrote in the paper, you know, we wanted to keep it simple. So if you can measure lactate is needed for the septic shock definition. If you're working in the middle of Africa, for example, and you can't measure lactate, then use the surrogate, for example, delayed capillary refill. So we're saying where you can measure lactate, that's when you use. If you can't, for logistic reasons, then you look for a surrogate, and we suggested, you know, capillary refill as an example of that.
Okay, and again, according to the septic shock, you mentioned that normally you will have some indices of adequate fruit recitation. Do we need to have something quite standardized, like a given amount of fruit, or is it more an assessment at the bedside we need to have to ensure the needs, the fruit adequacy is okay?
As I mentioned in my talk, but I'll re-emphasize it, that because there's nothing in the literature to say what does adequate mean. You know, some people look at CVP, some people look at Starling curve, some people look at, you know, respiratory swing, and there's no strong literature base, and everybody does it differently. So we couldn't mandate that you have to measure stroke volume in every patient, because that wouldn't happen in real life. So therefore, you know, we had to be pragmatic and say, look, as you in your hospital with your current practice define adequate, that's what adequate means. Clearly, it will vary from hospital to hospital, but at the end of the day, we stuck with thing we thought was a pragmatic solution, because if we said you have to do it this way, we would get 50 or 60 or 70% of the world population complaining that we don't do it this way, we don't believe in this. So as a pragmatic suggestion, accepting, you know, there are issues, but we're saying do it the way you currently do it. But it is a difficult question. You know, the surviving sepsis campaign cannot define adequate, and they also recognize that depending on what technology and tools you use, it does vary from hospital to hospital.
Yes, I agree. About the science, I mean, when you are, you mentioned that on the ward, the queue so far performed as good as other fighters. When you have other variable available, let's say you can see that your patient has a decrease in platelet count from 180 to 50. Could this be used instead of the tachypnea if your patient is not tachypneic, to mention that indeed your patient has sepsis now because of this increase in SOFA score at the in the ward or in the emergency department also, or you need to use the Q-SOFA?
Right. So no, the Q-SOFA is, let me just see, while I'm talking, let me just see if I can find it. No, what if you look at the paper, the main paper, we very clearly wrote that, sorry, I'm just looking to see if I can dig it out, but we very clearly wrote that, sorry, I'm just trying to find it and put it up on the screen.
No, take your time.
Sorry, but there is an algorithm in the here we go. There is an algorithm in the paper. Let me just show it now. Can you see on your screen, Daniel?
Yes, we see it. We see that you are trying to open it. Yes, open.
Yeah, I found it. Right, here we go.
Yes, open.
Yeah. Right. So if you see, this is in the paper, and I'll blow it up as big as I can. Oops, sorry, that's too big. So can you see that clearly?
Yeah.
Can you see that?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, so you have a patient with suspected infection. You can do the quick bedside prompt. Have they got two or more Q-SOFA points? If the answer is yes, and we give the variables here, if the answer is yes, you do the blood tests, which you would do clinically anyway, because you're worried about the patient, and that will tell you if they have two or more SOFA points. So the platelets may, obviously, a low platelet count would give you SOFA points. If, on the other hand, you have Q-SOFA of 0 or 1, but you're still worried about the patient, they may be oliguric, they may be hypoxemic, you're still worried, do the blood tests. And the SOFA score may actually show that they have organ dysfunction that the Q-SOFA has not necessarily indicated. The problem is, do you want every single patient on the ward? Do you want to do cultures, lactate, blood tests, etc.? Do you want to do that for every single patient? And in real life, the answer would be no. So you're looking at the patients who have two or more QSOFA, or you're worried about they don't have two or more, but you're still worried enough to take the blood tests, which would allow you to look at QSOFA. If you're not worried, they have a low QSOFA score, you're not worried about them, just keep an eye on them, reevaluate them. If they deteriorate, obviously, then you definitely need to be taking more interest in investigating, etc. So it's very much a case of, if you're worried about the patient, despite the fact their QSOFA is 0 or 1, do the blood test, look at the renal function, look at the platelets, and if they have that SOFA score of 2 or more, then they fulfill the criteria for sepsis.
Okay, thank you very much for this clarification. I think it was very useful. I think that we come to the end of this webinar. For the people still on board, and I see that you are still numerous, the webinar has been registered and will be available on the website. And there was a few questions on the availability of the slides. I think that you intend to do something different with the slides. Mervyn, could you explain what you wish to do with the slides or slide set?
So, thank you, Daniel. No, what we hope to do, we gave the presentation a few days ago at the American SCCM meeting in Orlando, and we want to make that slide set available. That was an hour. There were four speakers talking for an hour. I'm also very happy to have this slide set available too. So, for the message, the education to come over. So, in the next, hopefully, in the next few days, all of the slides will be available.